Hello and welcome to the Inspired Thinkers podcast series by Arate House. My name is Toby Mendelson and this episode is called Nagarjuna, I Am Not I. Now I should say right away that of all the figures in this series, Nagarjuna is the one that I ought to know best, in that I've spent a very long time studying him, and my academic credentials are staked more on his name and his ideas than any other figure. But there is something very elusive about Nagarjuna. He seems to disappear the very moment you start looking for him. And your voice trails off into silence the very moment you start speaking about him. Silence and disappearing seem to be the best ways to explain his philosophy, which is a rather unorthodox approach, to say the least. And Nagarjuna is a figure who has followed me, like a ghost, everywhere I've gone. But after all these years, I'm still not really sure who he is and what it is his philosophy has imparted on me. One of the reasons for his ghost-like elusiveness is that no one quite knows when or where he existed. So there's now some scholarly consensus that he probably lived somewhere in southern India, maybe in modern-day Andhra Pradesh or Karnataka, maybe sometime in the 2nd century AD. But it's always a maybe, a probably. So it's hard to actually find the historical figure, Nagarjuna. Nonetheless, his influence is undoubtedly tremendous. So philosophy is a little bit like pop music in the sense that if you have only one name, like Madonna or Prince, then you're automatically in the pantheon of greats. And like Plato and Aristotle, Nagarjuna is firmly in such a pantheon. But he simultaneously remains very obscure because his place of origin is India, instead of ancient Greece or modern Europe. And I think we can all recognize that the history of philosophy and the history of ideas is still very much Eurocentric in its orientation. So for that reason, Nagarjuna is very much on the margins of philosophy from the Western point of view, but not from the point of view of South or East Asia, where his influence has been and in a way remains very, very immense. So Nagarjuna was an Indian Buddhist philosopher, but it should be noted that his work profoundly shaped not only Buddhist philosophy, but Indian philosophy per se, and over time, Chinese philosophy and Japanese philosophy. Within the Buddhist tradition, Nagarjuna was at the forefront of what became known as the Madhyamaka, which means the middle way school. And this is really the central axiom upon which most of the Mahayana Buddhist traditions are anchored. So through this episode, we'll try and touch upon, penetrate, this meaning of middle way, Madhyamaka. And as I'll be doing through the series, I'm just going to give a very brief and succinct explanation of his philosophy, which hopefully goes beyond silence and disappearing, and then move into a more personal narrative about my relationship to his thinking. So, what is Nagarjuna's philosophy? Well, it is very, very subtle and difficult, obtuse and often downright strange. But in the same breath, it's also profound and intuitive and simple. I suppose it could also be called beautiful and maybe even powerful. The essence of his doctrine is a defense of the proposition that all things, ourselves, our bodies, other beings, things in the world like trees and supermarkets, all things are shunya, empty. And the nature of reality is shunyata, emptiness. That's really Nagarjuna's philosophy. But what does that actually mean? What does it mean to say that everything is empty and that reality is emptiness? And right away we land in very deep trouble, because one of the many paradoxes of Nagarjuna is that he himself denies offering any kind of philosophy or view. So he writes in his magnum opus, his text called the Mulamadyamka Karikaka, at the end of chapter 13, he writes, "The victorious ones have said that emptiness is the relinquishing of all views. For whomever emptiness is a view, that one will accomplish nothing." He also writes at the very end of the text, the final stanza, he writes, "I prostrate to Gautama," that's the historical Buddha, "who through compassion taught the true doctrine which leads to the relinquishing of all views." So in other words, emptiness cannot be a theory or view of the world, a view that you can learn conceptually and then apply to make sense of it. It cannot be a philosophy in that sense. And in fact, the very moment you do that, you end up totally missing the point. Okay, so if that's the case, then does it mean we just put down theory and philosophy altogether? Is that really what Nagarjuna is suggesting? And there's actually a lot of people who think that is indeed the main message of Nagarjuna. That the problem with human life is that we're all compulsive thinkers, and that our ceaseless thinking, our having endless opinions, having beliefs about things, is the root problem, the thing which keeps us in constraint. And so what we really have to do is to relinquish that. In other words, Nagarjuna is imploring us to surrender our thinking mind, our intellect, our theories about reality, our conceptual edifice. You might say that in modern terms, he's saying, just stop reading articles about Donald Trump. And for God's sake, stop writing online comments about him. It's just getting you into confusion. Now, in some ways, there is indeed some truth to that interpretation of Nagarjuna. On one level, and in a very important sense, that is indeed what he's saying. But that's not all that he's saying. And that view also has some very grave limitations. Because he wrote a great deal more than those stanzas, imploring one to relinquish all views. And in many other stanzas, he's clearly giving a very precise and particular defense of a core Buddhist metaphysical view called in Sanskrit Patitya Samudpada, which translates to dependent co-arising or dependent co-origination. And this is really, according to Nagarjuna, a very subtle theory of causation. So in a very important sense, to assert or propose that something is empty is to say that it can only exist in the form of a dependent co-arising. And this is indeed the very heart of Nagarjuna's philosophy. So what does that mean? It means simply that no thing can exist from its own side. There's nothing at all that can exist in and of itself as its own independent being or substance. The only way anything can exist is in dependence on a whole bunch of causes and conditions, an assemblage of causes and conditions. And that is indeed the nature of reality. So to put the matter very bluntly and loosely, in a way what Nagarjuna is saying is, don't expect an apple tree to emerge from an apricot seed. And don't expect it to emerge from nothing. If you want an apple, you need to get an apple tree. And to get an apple tree, you need an apple seed. And to make an apple seed grow, you need a whole range of causes and conditions. You need plentiful sun, plentiful water, good soil, and so forth. And you need the time for the tree to grow and the tree to fruit. And when at last an apple emerges on the tree, and you go there and you pick it, to say that it's empty is to say that it is what it is only in lieu of all of those things. So there's no independent apple. There's only an apple which is dependent on the tree being dependent on the seed being dependent on good soil and so forth. So to some degree, that's actually incredibly intuitive and simply common sense. It's very hard to argue against that. Who's going to try and argue that an apple can emerge from an apricot seed? So in this respect, there's nothing particularly difficult or challenging about what Nagarjuna is saying. Which raises a question, well, if that's the case, why is he such an influence? Why has he been so influential? Why is he considered so profound and difficult? And there's another bit to all of this which I think is really important to contemplate and understand. And in a way, what Nagarjuna is saying is that we actually tend to totally fail to see things in that way. We tend often to ignore causation, to overlook the complexity of causation. And worse than that, we tend to see ourselves and others and things in the world as actually having independent existence. So in other words, our very mode of apprehending reality, our mode of understanding ourselves and our lives and our world, is predicated on missing the emptiness of it, on missing the dependent co-arising of it. So there's somehow or other a gap between how we tend to apprehend the world and how the world actually is. And it's right there where Nagarjuna's philosophy becomes subtle and difficult and profound. So to some degree, what I learnt after all these years was, rather than looking for emptiness, you have to look for what is not emptiness. That's really the trick. Now, I could say a lot more there, but I'd like to move into the narrative part. And I suppose you might be wondering, how did I actually get into Nagarjuna in the first place? It's a rather curious thing to be living in the 21st century amidst all the developments in neuroscience and biology, and somehow or other being attracted to an ancient Indian Buddhist philosopher. So why did that happen? Why did he command so much effort and energy in trying to understand him? Well, I actually first encountered the notion of shunyata, or emptiness, well before I encountered Nagarjuna. And in fact, it's not a notion which Nagarjuna invented or made up. It could be argued that the notion even predates the Buddha, could be found in certain readings of the early Upanishads. But nonetheless, since the time of the Buddha, Shunyata has been very central to the unfolding of Buddhist philosophy and practice. It's there in the Nikayas and it's there in the later Prajnaparamita sutras. So in any case, as a young man, I was probably about 19 or 20. And I was interested in Buddhism more generally. So I was reading some introductory books about it. And in doing so, this notion of emptiness came up front and square. And there seemed to be this emphasis that if you really want to understand Buddhism, then you really have to understand what it is that emptiness means. And I wanted to understand Buddhism. And from there I proceeded to make every conceivable elementary mistake in trying to understand what it is that emptiness is. And I can probably boil all of those mistakes down to two basic forms. The first is turning emptiness into a something, some elusive essence, or realm, or place, or thing, which is the buried treasure of human life, something that the Buddhists have discovered, but which everyone somehow misses. Maybe something akin to spirit, or luminosity, or some place of peace, or heart, or tranquility, or whatever. Who knows what? I certainly didn't. But I had that sense that emptiness is definitely a something real that you can find or reach or become or attune to or get close to. And that is the first profound error. The other elementary error is turning it into a nothing, which is to say, it becomes an absolute negation of all things. Of the self, of me, of you, the tree, the supermarket. That to assert that it's all empty is to assert that it doesn't actually exist, that it's not actually real. And it's very easy to fall into that second mistake, because if you read some of the literature, it speaks in precisely those kinds of terms. So it's really easy to get misled by the language. So I made both of those kinds of errors. And in Nagarjuna's terms, which I learned much later, that really is what is meant by falling into the extremes of either existence or non-existence, of being or non-being, of eternalism or nihilism. And in fact, the very meaning of Madhyamaka is a middle way precisely between those kinds of extremes. So probably there's actually no way to get there without making those kinds of errors. Part of the argument of Nagarjuna is that we naturally dwell in those sorts of extremes in our day-to-day existence. So probably it's impossible to avoid those kinds of mistakes. In any case, I really had many years of getting it very wrong before I even encountered Nagarjuna. And along the way, his name cropped up. A lot of those more introductory books and texts mention Nagarjuna. At some point or another, I realized that Nagarjuna is somehow an important figure in all of this discussion. And I remember finding one book directly on him in a public library. It was simply called Nagarjuna's Philosophy by someone whose name completely escapes me today. So I remember being very pleased to find it and even somewhat proud to carry it home in my arms. I think I was thinking something like, you know, all this stuff about emptiness, which I'm trying to understand, is actually a philosophy. So it perversely gave me a kind of legitimacy in engaging with it. But then reading it was rather a different story. It was very, very dry and exceedingly boring. And I basically didn't grasp a single thing. And that was really my first encounter with Nagarjuna. And I'd say that's probably a pretty common response. He's certainly not a figure one would read for literary pleasure. And the next thing I remember, which was quite a few years after that, was reading him as part of an undergraduate course on Buddhist philosophy. And we actually read a chapter from his magnum opus, the Mula Madhyamaka Karikaka, which I talked about before. And that was the first time I actually read his actual text. And we read a chapter there called On Fire and Fuel. And reading that gave me the sense of being involved with something extraordinarily difficult. It was very, very logical. And it felt like Nagarjuna was playing chess with words. And reading him was like getting checkmated. And it didn't help that I was something of an anti-rationalist at that stage. I much preferred more intuitive or literary or poetic modes, metaphorical ways of dealing with things rather than rational ones. And actually, to be frank, I wasn't particularly good at logic. So reading him in that way, I kind of developed the sense that Nagarjuna was actually just too hard. And more directly, that I wasn't particularly interested in him. I'd like to read people that would inspire me rather than checkmate me. Nonetheless, this concept of emptiness still gnawed away at me. And I developed, you know, a whole lot of ideas about it. And I was still very much uncertain about whether or not they were good ideas or true ideas. And the next major turning point was probably a few years after that. Suitably enough, it was at a Buddhist monastery in Nepal, where I decided to spend the summer. And it was very intense and sublime and beautiful living there, and a great deal happened. But two things in particular stand out on reflection. First of all, I received teachings on emptiness by a Tibetan Gelugpa Lama. And that's important because the traditional way to understand it is precisely in that way. You get introduced to it by someone who really knows the terrain. And in a way they guide you through it. You don't just read a book and expect to grasp it from reading. And the second thing, in total contradiction to the first thing, is that while I was there, I did just read a book. And the book was by the founder of that tradition, the Gelugpa tradition, a 14th century yogi called Tsongkhapa. And Tsongkhapa was one of the most influential interpreters of Nagarjuna. So much of the book was about Nagarjuna and emptiness. And so it was actually in this context, on the hills just outside Kathmandu, that the penny finally began to drop. And as it dropped, it exposed a very deep dogma, which I was holding and which I had held for most of my adult years. And that dogma was the anti-rationalism that I had spoken about just a few moments ago. So, somehow or other, I had connected the notion of emptiness with romantic ideas of intuition or some kind of pure space, a space free of thinking, free of language, free of logic, a space which was more poetic in character, which you could enter So I thought that maybe emptiness was this kind of almost aesthetic key, which would give me access to a beautiful space beyond the clunkiness of our human rationality and understanding. Which, you know, in hindsight is a mystical misreading of Nagarjuna. So I realized, or you might say that I was convinced by reading Tsongkhapa, that contrary to that, you actually need to deploy all of your rational faculties. All of your rational faculties in trying to understand emptiness. You actually have to do the logical work. So despite the ever-present warnings that emptiness is not a view, that the intellect, theory, thinking, concepts, reason and logic are all leading you away from reality, that despite that, somehow or other you actually need them in order to penetrate this elusive thing called shunyata. So that penny dropped, and upon returning home to commence an honours year, somewhat coincidentally, that's exactly what I began to do. And one of the coincidences was that there just happened to be a whole honours course running, devoted to one of the main Indian interpreters of Nagarjuna. This is an Indian philosopher called Chandrakirti. Not only that, but the course was run by a professor of philosophy who was most famous for his groundbreaking work on mathematical logic. So he was a man who had taken logic and reason to its most subtle and potent places. So quite frankly, given that I'd only just recently given up my anti-rationalist prejudices, I was somewhat terrified to be studying under him. I'm not sure precisely what it was that I was afraid of, but maybe deep down, I thought that the sharpness of his logical mind would expose my own thinking to be naive or idealistic or unfounded. So in any case, I took this course, and finally, at long, long last, I started to make some real progress in understanding Nagarjuna and understanding emptiness. And I in fact decided to write my thesis on emptiness, so I was in a way forced to spend the whole year reading good scholarship and basically cracking my head against it all year. So by the year's end, I'd produced a small thesis, and I felt like I finally understood, at least a little bit, what this thing, emptiness, is all about. At least on a philosophical level, and at least superficially. And that year really magnified into another 5 years, because I won a scholarship, and so in a way I was getting paid to study Nagarjuna under the tuition of this very famous logician, who incidentally I came increasingly to admire and appreciate. Now, I have to conclude that by the end of all that, I did have a much better idea of what emptiness means than when I started. But I want to end the episode by leaving the sphere of scholarship and academia and philosophy and entering the sphere of contemplation. Because actually that's really what Nagarjuna and emptiness is all about. So there's a wonderful quote which demonstrates this kind of process. And the quote was by a scholar of Madhyamaka called Robert Thurman, and he wrote, "Wise intuition is a fruit of long philosophic cultivation of critical insight, developed in sustained contemplation of the profound nature of things, until reason transforms instinct and habit, and what one knows rationally to be the case is intuitively felt to be the case." So there's some kind of process where all the theorizing, all the analysis, all the philosophical work transforms into a kind of contemplative understanding of reality. And actually, I think it was quite a long time after I finished all of my philosophical work that the fruits of Nagarjuna and his philosophy of emptiness began to start ripening in my contemplative life. And I want to end the episode by briefly talking about that. Now, it is, of course, a hard thing to speak about, because as we've learned all the way through, that for Nagarjuna and the Madhyamaka tradition, the whole caper really does resist words and language. So you use words and language and reason and analysis only insofar as you get it. And when you get it, you then step out of them. So in this respect, going back to those earlier stanzas, silence is ultimately the only way to encapsulate the notion of emptiness. It is something to be experienced rather than talked about. But obviously in a podcast, that's not going to take us very far. And I think there are a few things that can be said, which I think are actually very practical and accessible, usable tools which I myself have used and which I have found to work, and which are in many ways foundational to a good and flourishing life. And the first of these is simply the art of relinquishing, of giving something up, surrendering. So emptiness as a contemplative practice is intimately connected to this. It is a practice of giving up the self, which is extraordinarily simple and at the same time powerful, potent, and sublime. So what needs to be relinquished? And what does it mean to relinquish something? Well, by relinquishing the self, it really means everything in our world, our bodies, our minds, our opinions, our beliefs, our relationships, our possessions, our vocations and careers. In that, the quintessential problem of human life is that we hold on to everything. And not just hold, but tightly hold, grasp. When you grasp at something, your mind and body automatically become tight. You become a knot full of tension. And in a way, you could say that the observation of Nagarjuna is that most people are basically walking, talking knots of tension, to such an extent that they don't even realize that that is what they are. And yet, the perversity is that there is absolutely nothing to be gained by grasping in that way. That when you relinquish, everything still remains in its right place. You don't lose your body. You don't lose your mind. You don't lose your possessions. You don't lose any of the things that you relinquish. You just lose the part of you that is gripping, like a tyrant, to power. And in fact, all of those things that you are grasping become liberated, simply because the very thing that was containing them has been overcome. And really, the point, which is profoundly simple, is you actually don't need to hold things tightly. I think sport is a very good example here. So think of the way that the tennis player either tightens up or gets into the flow of the game. And actually commentators speak about that sometimes. They say, oh, so-and-so has really tightened up. And it's obvious when they do that. They start grasping. And they totally fall apart. Their game falls apart. So it's in this sense that emptiness is the antidote to that ingrained tendency. It's very practical. And it's a beautiful and necessary art to learn. The second point is a little more esoteric or yogic. And it is in many ways simply an extension of the first point. It's often referred to in the literature as the co-emergence of mind and phenomena. And if that sounds a little glossy and exotic, well, that's good, it should sound that way. Because it is glossy and exotic. But it's also totally natural and simple and easy. And it simply means this, that when you start perceiving things in their empty context, there becomes an inseparability between your perception and the object of your perception. The two occur together, with nothing in the way of it. Now, the point about this is if you don't have that, if you don't have that inseparability between your perception and the object of your perception, then it doesn't matter how precious your objects of perception are, whether they be fancy cars, or good food, or good music, good art, nice hotels, whatever it is. No matter what they are, you actually can't access them properly because there's some kind of gap between you and it. Where there's a gap of that nature, it's actually not possible to really enjoy them. So even if you're a fully committed hedonist, and your only goal in life is to maximize as much pleasure as you can possibly have, there's actually no possibility of doing that if you can't close the gap between your perception and the object of perception. So, you know, to really enjoy something, you actually have to really enter into it and in some ways become unified with it. So it implies seeing it in its true reality. And emptiness, in this sense, is the art of doing that, of doing away with the gap between you and reality, between you and the objects of the phenomenal world. And actually, this implies people too. And this is what raises it to the level of something altruistic and compassionate rather than hedonistic. It's also a point which is perhaps quite aligned with Martin Buber's philosophy, which we discussed in the previous episode, that in order to properly relate to another person, you have to go beyond just seeing that person as an object for you. You have to undo the gap between you and that person. And only then can you appreciate them in their proper context, their empty context, their context of dependent co-arising. And only on that basis can you relate to them genuinely. And that's why emptiness is considered to be indivisible from compassion. At least from the Buddha's point of view, it's the only way in which a true compassion is made possible. So that's actually a nice place to pause and reflect. So thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more podcasts in the Inspired Thinker series at aratehouse.com.au.